This is special coverage from WBUR in Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. For the last 24 hours, U.S. Psychological Operations aircraft have been broadcasting instructions to Afghan civilians to prepare to see U.S. troops. Here's the message beaming down from the EC-130 aircraft. Attention, people of Afghanistan. United States forces will be moving through your area. We are here for Osama bin Laden, Al-Qaeda, and those who protect them. Please, for your safety, stay off bridges and roadways and do not interfere with our troops or military operations. If you do this, you will not be harmed. So, the word is out. U.S. commandos are on the ground. In this hour, we'll look at what special forces can and cannot do to decide the war on terrorism. Earlier, I spoke with BBC defense correspondent Jonathan Marcus, who pointed out the complexities that troops face on the ground in Afghanistan.
Well, as we understand it, there seem to be small teams of U.S. special forces, both in the north of the country, liaising with the Northern Alliance, the anti-Taliban forces there, but also, perhaps much more interesting, in what is nominally Taliban-controlled territory in the south, trying to liaise with tribal groupings there who might clearly, possibly be persuadable, if you like, to give up their alliance with the Taliban and move over and to oppose them. That seems to only have been going on for a day or so, as far as we know. So clearly it's not ground war, it's not ground combat, but one of the very typical roles, particularly for U.S. special forces, of liaison with foreign military forces.
So this is not snatch-and-grab commando activity, but talking with Afghans on the ground?
As we understand it, yes. I think clearly in the south as well, there must have been some activity by the CIA. I mean, we only know this from reports, but one would expect this to be going on. And probably some of this military activity is linked to that. I think one of the key players here as well is going to be the Pakistani Secret Intelligence Service. I think they clearly are the people who have the best links into Afghanistan and into the extraordinary kind of complexity of tribal groupings and clan groupings and warlords and so on. And I'm sure the Pakistan's intelligence services are probably working very, very closely with the Americans in this particular area.
Is it known if British special forces are also engaged there?
There's been a lot of talk, actually, from quite early on in the conflict about the possibility of small numbers of British special forces being on the ground. I don't imagine that they would have been performing this liaison role necessarily. There's been suggestions that small teams may be on the ground helping to build the intelligence picture, perhaps helping to select some of the targets for the air operations. That, though, is just speculation. The British government, by and large, doesn't talk about such operations. But once again, the traditional and classical role, or one of the roles of special forces, to be dropped in behind the lines and to gather intelligence. Obviously, the aim being not to be seen. We all see the sort of Schwarzenegger movies with people kicking down doors and sowing mayhem around them. I mean, I think the reality of special forces is that by and large they operate unseen. That's their preference, to basically observe, to watch, to gather information.
Both your prime minister and our defense secretary have pointed out that air power alone will not get the job done in Afghanistan. What else might special forces be required to do beyond this liaison and building relationships with Afghans? Is there a combat role anticipated?
I think, again, it's speculation, but I think it's quite clear that there is a potential combat role. And obviously, the Americans particularly have been gathering very significant forces into the region. I mean, we know that there are, or we believe that there are special forces on board the USS Kitty Hawk, one of the U.S. carriers in the Arabian Sea. We know that a number of air bases in Pakistan are clearly available potentially for staging operations at the very least. We know, too, that certainly specialized forces, elements of the 10th Mountain Division, have been brought into a base in Uzbekistan. Clearly, other special forces may possibly be there as well. So clearly there is the potential for quite large-scale special forces operations. And I think the question really to be asked is whether this will be, if you like, intervention light. Will it be relatively small groups of people keeping in to conduct very specific missions, or will there be a much heavier intervention intention, perhaps a desire to hold a piece of real estate in Afghanistan, maybe a key air base. I mean, people often point to this northern air base in Mazar-e Sharif as a potential location there. That would obviously give a base on the ground where helicopters could refuel and that type of thing. But we just don't know. And I mean, the key point, obviously, is in a sense, there isn't a simply military solution to this crisis at all. The aim, after all, is to change the government in Afghanistan, to try and turn it into a country which doesn't harbour a huge terrorist organisation within its midst. This cannot be achieved by force alone. There is clearly no intention to invade Afghanistan, and a lot of the fighting and some of the key fighting is clearly going to have to be done either by factions who are simply opposed to the Taliban or by the withering away of the Taliban because some people desert them and move over to the other side.
Is it reasonable to expect that special forces might end up fighting shoulder to shoulder alongside Afghan opposition forces?
Well, I think it is. It's a reasonable assumption. I think at the point in time, and remember, there is this kind of reluctance. Everybody wants to support the Northern Alliance, but only so far, essentially because the Northern Alliance is not a tremendously representative group of people. They don't represent the largest ethnic group in the country, the Pashtuns, who are about 40% or so of the ethnic makeup of Afghanistan. So any eventual political arrangement may include the Northern Alliance, but it cannot solely be the Northern Alliance. They also have been responsible for some fairly unpleasant things last time they were in Kabul. So nobody wants to see them just sweep into Kabul tomorrow morning. I think, though, if the pieces can be got into place, if the various, if there are defections, if there is emerging some sort of political formula that looks as though it could replace the Taliban, then I think clearly some form of Northern Alliance offensive on the ground is going to be a critical element. Now, the decisive factor there is going to be harnessing U.S. air power to assist in that ground offensive. And I think there one can clearly speculate that forward air controllers from the special forces, other specialized liaison teams might well operate on the ground alongside the Northern Alliance forces to help, you know, link them up to America's clearly extraordinary firepower.
John Marcus is a correspondent for the BBC. I spoke to him earlier from London. How might special forces help turn the tide in the war in Afghanistan? Joining me now from New Hampshire is William Arkin, military columnist for thewashingtonpost.com. Good evening, William Arkin.
Hi, how are you tonight?
Great, good to have you. Also with us is Mark Bowden. He joins us from Philadelphia. He wrote Black Hawk Down, the story of the 1993 special forces disaster in Mogadishu, Somalia. Hello, Mark Bowden.
Hi.
Good to have you. Also with us is special coverage news analyst Jack Beattie, joining us from the studios this evening of Vermont Public Radio. You can join the conversation, too, at 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. The military action is rolling ahead in Afghanistan. Do you think that putting U.S. troops on the ground, special forces on the ground, is the right move? Mark Bowden, you have covered special forces quite wonderfully in a number of venues in Somalia, in Colombia. Paint a picture for us, if you would, of what Afghans are likely to see or not see as U.S. special forces show up. What's the drill here? How will they appear, make their appearance on the scene?
Well, what they won't see, which is easier to answer, is huge invasion of infantry and tanks, a sort of conventional land war. And they won't see the kind of fighting that the Soviets did in Afghanistan in the 1980s. What they're likely to see are small groups of special forces soldiers who will train people who are fighting the Taliban, who will coordinate air support for ground forces. They might see small units of special forces soldiers moving through parts of the territory, either doing surveillance or potentially on their way to some kind of confrontation. They might see an individual soldier, frankly, hiding in the mountains, setting up a surveillance platform.
We've heard that special forces tend to travel in groups as small as 2 to 3, or maybe as many as a dozen. Is that common to go in with that small number?
It is. It depends on the mission. These men are trained to function independently, and they can work perfectly well in just with one person or in a small group. They also work in teams. They can go out in as many as 20 or 30 men, the Delta Force operators, and if it's in a situation calls for a big backup of light infantry, they would bring in the Rangers.
We're hearing a broader range of activity than I think the kind of Rambo commando image brings to mind. This almost diplomatic role of liaison on the ground to try and bring factions together. But is there a fighting edge that obviously has to be here? What's the range of capacities at the fighting end for Special Forces?
Well, they're, you know, some of the best war fighters in the world. They're certainly within our military the best small unit fighting forces. What they're capable of doing, what they do probably better than anyone, is planning to conduct a small, violent raid on a target. So one of the obvious things that I can envision in Afghanistan is if our human intelligence and imagery and electronic surveillance manage to pinpoint a location where certain wanted terrorists are hiding, mm-hmm. or camped, you would see probably at night, coming in on helicopters, a rapid, violent takedown of that spot.
Mm-hmm.
And that would be conducted by however many soldiers would be necessary. It would depend on the setting, on how many people were there to defend it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, every plan is drawn up according to what the specifics of that target are.
Bill Arkin, joining us in New Hampshire, it hasn't been said explicitly, but the impression that we've been given from the beginning here is that bombing and special forces will do the trick. We won't need to bring in greater numbers of troops than that. Do you believe that it can be as surgical and kind of simple as that?
Well, nothing about it is simple, and one of the things that we should be very modest about is the time frame that we're talking about under which this is all going to unfold. Though the news today was that special forces had arrived in Afghanistan, we know that there had been small reconnaissance teams already in and out of the country since mm-hmm. The beginning of the bombing, if not even before. And so, though we are entering a new phase because air defenses have been beaten back and because most of the infrastructure has been destroyed, it seems to me that the administration and particularly Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld are being very clear about dampening expectations that somehow this is going to be a quick lightning strike. The other thing I guess I would say about the comments made earlier by Mark is that while those are a description of classical special forces operations, mm-hmm. I think that there's something different going on here in Afghanistan. If it were the case that there were a camp of terrorists or Taliban that were identified somewhere by U.S. intelligence, we have the airplanes to go after that camp. The point of special forces in inside Afghanistan is twofold, and I'm not talking about those special forces that are doing reconnaissance or are helping the Northern Alliance. I'm talking about the direct action teams. They are to leapfrog over the Northern Alliance and to go into places where airplanes can't go, into urban areas, into places, into command centers, into places where the actual leadership of the Taliban and the Al-Qaeda are located, mm-hmm. places where airplanes and cruise missiles can't go.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think we're going to see the types of attacks that Mark is describing. I think that those types of attacks can be undertaken by air power. If we know where there is a Taliban or Al-Qaeda concentration of troops, we can bomb them.
Mm.
I think that the point of what's unfolding here to this week and what we'll see going on over the next period of time is so disrupting the routine, the operational security, the transportation, the infrastructure of the Taliban and Al-Qaeda leadership so that they have to expose themselves in some way. Now, one of the things that they're clearly going to do is they're going to collapse into the urban areas because by surrounding themselves in an urban area amongst civilians, the theory is that they're going to be better protected. And I think that special forces, combined with U.S. air power, combined with U.S. intelligence, are going to essentially try to seek and hunt down specific targets. I would almost think of the special forces in this regard as being a human airplane, a precision-guided human being that is looking for specific targets but not to engage the enemy overall.
William Arkin, we've got to take a break right here. We'll be back. We're talking about the arrival of U.S. special forces on the ground in Afghanistan. Are you feeling better now that they're there? Are you confident we'll win? Join us at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to special coverage from WBUR Boston. This is special coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the arrival of U.S. Special Forces on the ground in Afghanistan. We're told it will be a long conflict, but we're also told that Special Forces should probably be able to carry the burden of it, or at least that's the implication that we're hearing from the Pentagon. We're joined this evening by William Arkin. He's a military affairs columnist for WashingtonPost.com and an adjunct professor at the School of Advanced Air Power Studies at the U.S. Air Force Air War College. Also by Mark Bowden, who wrote the quite spectacular book, Black Hawk Down, about the 1993 nightmare operation in Mogadishu that left 18 American soldiers dead. Also with us is Jack Beatty, our special coverage news analyst. You can join as well at 1-800-423-8255. Jack Beatty, there's a lot more I'd like to learn from Bill and Mark, but before we go to them, do you have any feeling here that despite the talk about how long this is going to go on, are we being inoculated against fear of a larger ground war by the notion that special forces can go in and take care of this business?
Well, they, you know, for a while in Vietnam, they had that character. President Kennedy was enamored of them. He had a green beret on his desk for a while, and I think we got the feeling then that, you know, somehow these super soldiers were going to win hearts and minds and show the people how to defend themselves, and we could get out of it on the cheap. Perhaps the things aren't analogous to situations aren't analogous today, but I want to pursue something with Mark. Mark, this isn't the first time that our special forces, broadly defined, have been up against bin Laden operatives. Can you tell us, give us the short course on Mogadishu in 1993, and especially sort of the resonances of it in this case, particularly the role of Colin Powell?
Well, I actually think, Jack, that the role that bin Laden and his operatives played in Somalia has been vastly overrated.
Oh.
I do think that it's probable that there were Somalis who had experienced fighting in Afghanistan, and there may well have been people from Al-Qaeda who came and went from Somalia just because it's one of the places in that region where, you know, they can move in and out fairly freely. There's no government and there's no real, you know, enforcement of anything there. But if you look at what happened on October 3rd of 1993, which is the battle that I wrote about in Black Hawk Down, you know, there was clearly an ambush that day, but it was an ambush by American soldiers on a target house in the middle of the city, and I've actually seen the videotape of that raid, and they achieved complete surprise. And frankly, if some of these al-Qaeda leaders who are claiming to have trained and led the Somali militias against the Americans are telling the truth, then we can all breathe a heavy sigh of relief, because it was basically a mob action. For every one American soldier who was killed, roughly 50 Somalis were killed. In fact, I think if the Somalis had any degree of tactical sophistication, none of those American soldiers would have made it out alive.
But Mark Bowden, I've stood in that street in Mogadishu, and it looks like it wasn't a fun place to be. We took a heavy loss that day, and it set us off our taste for intervention for a long, long time. Do you have reason to believe that it will be different when special forces are perhaps, let's say, in Kabul or Kandahar?
I really do think it'll be different because, I mean, what people lose sight of, and we always refer to what happened in Mogadishu as a disaster and a failure. In fact, American special forces went out that day to capture two lieutenants of Mohammed Farah Aidid. They caught them. They arrested them, and they took them out of the city. In the course of doing that, they wound up in a much bigger fight than they ever imagined or hoped that they would, and they acquitted themselves extremely well in the middle of it, although it was a, you know, perfectly terrifying battle. It was really the political will that was lacking here, because the loss of 18 American soldiers in that mission was enough to turn the Congress and the American people and the president off that whole mission, basically to call it off.
And this time?
This time it won't happen because, first of all, there's hardly anyone in this country who doesn't appreciate the stakes for the United States in this operation. We've been attacked in our homeland. I think there's a great deal of resolve and political support for this operation, and I think the president, frankly, has done a good job of preparing people for the fact that this is going to be potentially costly and long-term.
Bill Arkin, what's your comfort level that we can achieve the necessary achievements with special forces and air war?
Well, first of all, these are the only tools that are going to be applied, so it doesn't really matter what my comfort level is. We're not going to see the 82nd Airborne Division in there. We're not going to see three armored divisions. This is the war that has been designed. This is what this is what they're going to do. I think that what military sources are saying to me is, you know, this is going to go into and through the winter. And one of the questions that I guess we'll have to ask is going to be how many of our coalition partners in various types of coalitions who are supporting this action are going to stick with us. And then second, how much the American public is going to stick with it, not because they don't have the resolve that Mark has just described, but more because by having already 2 weeks of war in which not one airplane has been shot down and not one American has died, it creates an expectation that that is the nature of military action.
Let's get a feeling. Let's get a quick feeling for how the public might receive it. We have callers on the line. We're at 1-800-423-8255. Missy is calling from Durham, New Hampshire. Welcome, Missy.
Hi.
Hi.
I am concerned that this morning when the Pentagon or somebody, I think, asked the question, you know, do we have U.S. Special forces on the ground in Afghanistan, and nobody wanted to respond to that. They chose not to respond to that. I don't know why we did not, the media did not respect that, knowing that possibly they could be compromising those very soldiers on the ground. Why is it we have to be telling everybody that they attack in small groups in the middle of the night? I mean, isn't that sort of giving their enemy all of the information they need?
Missy, it's a reasonable question. Let's put it to the people who know. Bill Arkin, what about it? Do you think the media has overly exposed our special forces as they begin this operation?
Oh, absolutely not. I mean, first of all, Afghanistan is a place that is the size of the state of Texas, and we make it into much more of a Hollywood movie in our minds than we do in terms of actual reporting. Second of all, you know, no reporter who reports anything about the military doesn't check both the facts involved and also check the comfort level of the military and the government when they do their reporting. If anybody thinks that they have information that might be inimical to American interests, it's always checked with public affairs officials first before it goes to the air. And, you know, when things go on the air and you see at a press conference Secretary Rumsfeld saying, well, I don't want to answer that question, and then 20 minutes later it appears on NBC, what the public needs to understand is there are other military officials who are saying that because they want it on the air, because part of the news today of special forces being present in Afghanistan is psychological warfare against the Taliban and al-Qaeda. That this is part of the war plan, if you will, and the media is the conveyance under which we are demonstrating or under which we are communicating that we are escalating the level of conflict. That is exactly the message that government wants out there, and so the military and the media are sort of in coalition there. What's important then, therefore, is that the media provide the public with the context in which they can understand the prospects of success, because it's the public which has consented to the use of force.
Well, I know we don't have you forever, so let me just put it bluntly to you. How do you appraise our prospects for success in this mission?
Well, I appraise it as being fairly good in terms of defeating the Taliban, toppling the Taliban. I appraise it as being fairly bad in terms of our ability to destroy the al-Qaeda network. And I fear that if Osama bin Laden ends up on television, dead or alive, that's going to provoke an enormous recruitment campaign in the terrorist organizations and radical Islam all over the world. And so we're sort of on a track towards probably defeating the Taliban. We're on a track towards clearly disrupting al-Qaeda operations inside Afghanistan. But this is going to turn into a worldwide war against terrorism. And we already see in places like Indonesia, in Egypt, in Pakistan, et cetera, rioting, and that is only going to get worse. And I think that people perceive that we are the big bully in there, bombing a third world nation, that we are taking military action, and we believe because of the nature of air power, that we're doing it with impunity, and I think that that is going to mean a lot more terrorism in the future. The war on terrorism, as the government has said, is going to be a long-term war. It's going to be one that is going to lead to more casualties, and I think that that's how I see it unfolding. I don't see a quick strike on the part of special forces. Special forces are one tool in the toolkit, but by no means do I think people should be expecting that this war is going to be over anytime soon.
Mm. William Arkin, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
William Arkin is a senior military advisor to Human Rights Watch and adjunct professor at the School of Advanced Air Power Studies at the U.S. Air Force Air War College. Mark Bowden, you've written in great detail about operations of special forces. Do any of the stories that you've heard and told come to mind here as metaphors or pattern stories that may help us visualize what's going on or will go on the ground in Afghanistan?
Yeah, I would suggest that, you know, the story of how Pablo Escobar was tracked down and killed in Colombia in 1992 and 1993, which I described in my book Killing Pablo, is probably the most apropos, in that Escobar was a very powerful, wealthy, shrewd criminal, head of a very large organization that had so terrorized the country of Colombia that basically Escobar and his organization were above the law. A multi-billion dollar organization. The one difference between it and something like Al-Qaeda is that it was pretty much exclusively within Colombia, and we had the total cooperation of the Colombian government. And basically, American Special Forces went in 1992, and over a 15-month period, mapped, found, and assisted the Colombian government in either killing or arresting everybody who was significant in that group. And until finally, Pablo Escobar himself was isolated and running for his life and was found and killed in December of 1993.
We know that was a dramatic story. Now draw the distinctions for us.
Well, in Colombia, as I said, it was a purely Colombian operation, and Escobar was the head of a criminal gang, which is something I think that is probably easier to defeat than the kind of worldwide Islamic fundamentalist movement that we face in these extremists like Osama bin Laden.
Not as ideologically driven.
No, but I do think that the pattern that they used in Colombia is one that they're going to apply here, and that is that in order to get Escobar, it didn't involve sending in large numbers of troops, or it didn't even involve American soldiers making precision, you know, violent raids on anything. What it meant doing was creating an indigenous criminal organization that rivaled and fought Escobar's own, that it sort of turned Escobar's own tactics against him.
So is that how we use the Northern Alliance? Is that what you're suggesting?
I think the Northern Alliance, I think other, you know, organizations from countries throughout the Middle East. And what's going on in Afghanistan right now is just the noisiest part of this show. Mm-hmm. I expect that American Special Forces and law enforcement, and certainly our politicians and diplomats, are hard at work throughout that region, working with locals to try to recruit the sorts of organizations and intelligence networks that will be necessary to find and kill members of these terrorist cells.
We're talking about the arrival of U.S. Special Forces in Afghanistan, the announced arrival anyway, today. We're at 1-800-423-8255. This military action is pushing steadily ahead. Do you think that putting U.S. troops on the ground is the right move? Clearly it's what we're doing. Are you confident that we'll win this mission, this effort? Call us at 1-800-423-8255. Jack Beatty, I think we're all learning a lot every day as this unfolds. What's your confidence level feel like? You've heard both Mark and Bill speak to this.
Well, last night on the program, we had a young woman from Afghanistan, a refugee from there, mm-hmm. and we were asking her about the prospect of success here. And she said, this bombing campaign is just the wrong way to go because of its counterproductivity, because of its, because of the pictures it makes of mud huts blowing up and of and the creation of refugees and so on. She says, you know, if we what we've done is we have sort of made our face vulnerable. We've said we've got to get Bin Laden. She said the thing to have done was to blow up the camps and then, just as Mark says, get the Afghans to get Bin Laden. They know how to do that. That's what they do. And we could turn them, we could pay them, we could arm them. She said, but now that we've staked our face on getting Bin Laden, she's terribly afraid that we're going to be clomping around in that country with our special forces, but also with our bombs, and we're going to create just more misery for those people because we have staked our pride on what may have been an undeliverable goal, namely Osama bin Laden dead or alive. And she said, leave it up to the Afghans, supply them. Let them do the job. It's much better politically than any other solution you Americans can devise.
So, Mark Bowden, how about it? Do you think we had a choice? Could we have avoided the air war entirely and just gone in a la Colombia and given support to Afghans to go after Osama bin Laden?
No, I don't think we could have. I think I completely agree with what Jack has said and in his description of what the other person who was on the show was talking about, because I think that's exactly what we're going to do. But in order for special forces to operate on the ground safely in Afghanistan, and in order to sort of get opposition forces on their feet and up and moving, I think it was necessary to sort of totally destroy and disrupt the Taliban regime. I think that they've done that, so I would expect that any sort of bombing campaign would gradually ease out. And one of the advantages that you have when you have forces on the ground is that you have a whole lot more specific intelligence and targeting, so that the kind of bombings that we've been seeing in the last few weeks, I think, will be phased out.
Mark Bowden, we've just got a few seconds before the break, but talk to us about this liaison role of the special forces. Are they fluent in local languages? Are they trained as trainers of local military forces? They sound like diplomats in uniform almost. Is that the right way of seeing them?
That's exactly the right way to see them. These men are recruited because in some cases they do have language skills. If they don't have language skills, they have able translators with them. They're trained to be flexible, to listen to what the people they're working with want and need, and to adapt the American goal to the local goal in order to get the kind of cooperation that we need. The ideal forces operation is one where the American footprint is never even seen.
Are there operations like that going on all the time, or is this a rare application?
Well, I think they are going on all the time. Until I wrote the book Killing Pablo, I don't think most Americans were aware of the extent to which it was the United States Special Operations Forces that hunted down and killed Pablo Escobar.
We're talking about the arrival of U.S. Special Forces on the ground in Afghanistan. We're told that they're in the south today around Kandahar. There's also speculation that they're in other parts of the country and have been there a bit for a while. President Bush and his administration say that this will be the key spearhead on the ground in the U.S. mission in Afghanistan. And you've heard from our experts this evening that we're not anticipating any big, massive troops or equipment to come in behind them. What's your level of confidence that these elite American soldiers can get the job done? We're at 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. Let us know what you're thinking. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to special coverage from WBUR Boston. This is special coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the arrival of U.S. Special Forces in Afghanistan. Does it make you feel more comfortable tonight knowing that they're there pursuing Osama bin Laden and the Taliban? Or do you think it's right for us to be making war on the ground at all? Call us at 1-800-423-8255. We're joined this evening by our news analyst Jack Beatty and by Mark Bowden, author of Black Hawk Down and Killing Pablo, about the U.S.-assisted hunt for and death of Pablo Escobar, the Colombian drug lord. We have a call, Steve. Steve is on the line, and welcome, Steve. You're on the air.
Thanks.
Hi.
Well, I guess that my feeling is that we're in some sort of unreal movie from Hollywood, where they had that Dustin Hoffman or somebody was the director and he made a war.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that certainly the suffering that we had in New York City was horrific. And certainly the way to approach the problem, I'd like to have some sort of historical perspective. We're not going to get it in this context. The leadership is going to take advantage of the emotion, and they're going to launch towards that objective, and everybody's going to do it. Now, the point is that outside of the criminal act, which we could take care of by less violent means, why are we exerting such pressure in that sphere? Why are we there with Bahrain and Saudi Arabia and Iraq? Why? What are we fighting for in that area?
Got it, Steve. Let's put it to Mark Bowden. Mark, you hear the question. Steve's doubting the whole practical premise and says it's a kind of grandstanding. Do you buy that?
No, I don't. I mean, I think that in that region, particularly in Afghanistan and some other countries in that area, Saudi Arabia among them, Syria, Iraq, these cells of Islamic fundamentalist zealots have been allowed to build, to train, to plan. They've basically been making war on the United States for the last decade, proclaiming that they were going to kill Americans, going out and killing Americans, bombing our ships, bombing our embassies, you know, taking down the World Trade Center towers. I think at some point, in retrospect, I think we ought to be saying we should have been doing something more like this 5 or 6 years ago, or certainly after the embassy bombings in 1998. But I think we don't have any alternative as a nation, because sitting back and allowing these terrorist camps to function, allowing these cells to grow unmolested, will just lead, I think, to bigger and more horrific tragedies.
But, Mark, even now, only today, Russia's prime minister said today that the deployment was a mistake. He said, it's not Hollywood, kind of echoing our caller Steve's view. How can our intervention be different than the Soviet intervention in the hands of our special forces?
Well, because the Soviets were intervening to try to preserve and prop up a regime in that country that had become extremely unpopular, and they were facing essentially a popular uprising of which the Taliban was only one small part. We're not going in there to try to prop up any kind of a regime in Afghanistan, although there is talk now of, you know, what you do to help pull that country together after this search for al-Qaeda and the toppling of the Taliban takes place.
But you say that rather casually, Mark, but isn't that a pretty big challenge, that kind of creation of a regime?
I think it's a big challenge, but I don't foresee that as a, and I think it would be a mistake for that to become a United States operation. I think that that's something that inevitably would end up in the hands of the UN. The United States will probably play a part in it.
Jack Beatty, let me put that to Jack Beatty. Jack, do you share Mark's confidence that creation of the next regime can be put in the hands of the United Nations? We've talked about them doing nation building, but isn't there kind of a very, very volatile chemistry that's going to have to go on to bring together factions and produce any kind of stable regime in Afghanistan?
Yes, and as we've been learning, it'll have to be done not only with reference to Afghanistan, but with reference to Pakistan, that the government we install, or the government that is evolved from our participation in Afghanistan, has to pass muster with its southern neighbor, with its eastern neighbor. And in a way, that's the sort of offstage variable here. The deployment of the special forces now symbolically with the Northern Alliance is a sort of stick in the eye to Pakistan, because they have said, and said just recently, I think, to the Secretary of State in his trip through there, that they don't want the Northern Alliance to seize Kabul. They don't want the Northern Alliance to play a leading role in the next government. And here we have now put special forces in with the Northern Alliance. Perhaps it's not going to do anything for their military prowess, enough to get them into Kabul, but symbolically, the political symbolism of it is not helpful, I don't think.
Mark Bowden, do you see the special forces as being our forward negotiators on the ground who are actually going to be pulling together the different factions, alliances, ethnic groups, and painting a picture for them of some kind of power sharing that would lead to a stable and accepted government in Kabul?
No, I think that the military forces there play a much more restricted role, and that is to help pull together these units, show them how to fight, how to be effective, and coordinate any kind of American support for their activities. You know, from what I've seen in the last month, The United States has not been terribly eager to give a lot of support to the Northern Alliance. I think that they're, you know, using them along with what would hope to be, we would hope to be other factions in that country that would emerge. But I think that Jack and the caller are right in that, you know, when we topple the government of Afghanistan, if we successfully topple the Taliban, which I think is definitely going to happen, it does create a whole new set of problems, but a different order of problem, I think, than one where we have, you know, groups actively plotting to kill American citizens on a large scale. I just don't think we had any alternative.
There were hints in the Washington Post today from Pentagon officials saying that we're going to be applying some new weapons, some surprise weapons that people haven't seen before. Any sense of what that's about?
I don't, other than, you know, these reports of unmanned drones that carry weapons. That's certainly a new development in this war. But I don't really know what they're talking about, and frankly, I'm glad I don't.
Yeah, and do you have any sense, I bet you are, I bet, do you have any sense of how many troops we might ultimately be talking about? I mean, we hear small groups, but lots of small groups can make up a pretty large number.
Well, Special Forces itself is about 46,000 troops out of, what, more than a million people in the U.S. military.
Mm-hmm.
And there are units, conventional units, like the 10th Mountain Division there. You know, I'm terrible at making numerical estimates and things, but I know that it would defeat our purpose to have large numbers of American forces either in Afghanistan or even around it.
But it sounds like you, having watched Special Forces pretty closely, have a fair degree of confidence in their capability on the ground.
Well, I think that they'll accomplish what they set out to do, and I think that they'll successfully track down the Al-Qaeda network within Afghanistan. But I also think that that's probably the, as difficult as that will be, it's probably the easier of the tasks that they face.
Mark Bowden.
There, I just...
Jack, come right in. We just got a second.
I was just going to say, there our Afghan guest of the other night would disagree. She says the chances of finding bin Laden are very, very small, and she fears that he may already have ducked across the border disguising himself as a refugee.
You think he's sipping a margarita in Miami?
Maybe
he deserves it. Poisoned one.
Mark Bowden, thank you very much for joining us.
You're welcome, Tom. My pleasure.
You can continue this conversation online. Go to WBUR.org and click on Special Coverage Forums. Now, some sounds from a volatile week.
This latest scare at the Senate has only deepened the mystery as to where the anthrax is coming from.
I feel so badly for each of them. They are innocent people caught up in a matter for which they have nothing to do.
We're going to allow members to leave after today's business is done, and we will be screening the buildings this weekend through Monday.
All civilized nations must join together to defeat this threat. And I believe that the United States and China can accomplish a lot when we work together to fight terrorism.
This is a terrorist act, and we can only say with sadness that it comes one day after Prime Minister Sharon made very conciliatory remarks about the creation of a Palestinian state, and it is obvious that this terrorist activity here will render a very difficult situation even harder to solve.
We have no hard data yet, but it's clear that Mr. bin Laden is a man who's an evil man. He and his spokesman are openly bragging about how they hope to inflict more pain on our country.
Sounds from this last week when anthrax was everywhere and our president was in Shanghai and Americans continued to grapple with the meaning of everything that's unfolding. Jack Beatty, I was on the road a fair bit this last week, but you were watching closely. What's most got your attention out of this extraordinary week with the Congress closing and all the rest of it?
Well, one filament of potential good news and maybe even major good news. Today's New York Times reports that there's been a breakthrough in U.S.-Russian relations regarding the ABM treaty, that some kind of agreement is at hand that would perhaps allow us to proceed with some form of ABM, but at the same time make such cuts in our offensive arsenal as to offset the potential, change in the balance that an ABM treaty could introduce. Secondly, Colin Powell has apparently concluded, or at least there are reports of this, some sort of oil agreement with the Soviets, whereby we're going to take more of their oil, since it appears to be much more secure than other sources. I meant Russians. This is really important. This is the Bush administration came in with on a collision course, it looked like, with Russia, and now, because of the events of September 11th having set new possibilities afoot, it looks like the main irritant, let's keep our fingers crossed, of ABM, at least as a diplomatic problem, it looks like that's perhaps going to be solved. And secondly, it looks as if we're going to have even more material interest with Russia in terms of trade for oil.
And we're making nice with China at the same time, the country that President George Bush called our strategic competitor at the outset of his administration.
Yes, yes. Now, you were on the airline, so give us your story. What's it like out there?
Oh, I tell you, it was the first time that I had flown since September 11th, and I expect that many people are looking forward with some apprehensions to that first experience. I flew to Colorado, which was just close enough to a transcontinental flight to remind me of the entire 9/11 scenario. You know, big plane, wings full of fuel, and off we go. It was a very strange event. I was looking forward to it, Jack, thinking, like, you've got to get back on the horse when you're bucked off, some kind of that same apprehension. You know, the security lines were very long, especially in Colorado. The feeling in the airports I was in themselves was different. And, I hate to admit this, but it's hard. For all the encouragement we've had not to be racial profiling, not to be thinking that way, and Lord knows it's the last thing on earth I want to do, but yet you see people looking around and thinking about their fellow passengers. Mm-hmm. It's almost unavoidable. And then we talked earlier tonight about a national ID card and whether or not we should have it. But, you know, at every step in the security process, from the time you got to the airport to getting on the plane, you were asked again and again for the government-issued photo ID. And no one was going anywhere without that. So in some sense, that was already there. And then on the plane itself, a kind of aura of solemnity. People weren't chatting as much. They weren't moving around as much, I saw. People tended to get in their seat and stay there. Not much chit-chat. And that inevitable view down the long aisle of the cockpit door, which has a little more steel on it. There's some kind of diagonal strip of steel, but it still looks very thin and very flimsy. And, you know, at one point in the flight to Denver, the way toward the rear was blocked, and I walked forward toward the restroom at the front of the plane, which was immediately next to the cockpit door. And I found myself very deliberately adopting a kind of non-threatening body language as I walked up. You know, I'm not rushing.
Slow your pace.
Right, my hands are at my side. They're relaxed. I'm not rushing. But I think everybody on that plane was watching everything at every moment. I also saw less of the kind of self-indulgent air rage or indignation over minor hassles in the air that we've come to
people
associate.
Wanting their Perrier.
Yeah, you know, no one was talking about that. People are looking down. They're looking at the meal when it arrives. There's that plastic knife. Mm. And why is it plastic? But then there's a metal fork next to it. So, you know, you're faced with these contradictions. The cabin steward said, as we were ready for takeoff, he said, "Here we go. We're all in this together." And I think we all knew what he meant.
Oh, my gosh. So they're still alluding to the events in that way.
They're actively alluding, and you can see it in the eyes of folks there. The crew knows it's a new day. Jack, we've got to go. Thanks for joining us, and thanks for taking care of the show all week long.
I enjoyed it. Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. You've been listening to special coverage from